Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How are our lives shaped by the knowledge that someone we care about is facing imminent death? As founder of the Texas Innocence Network, attorney David R. Dow has worked to defend nearly 100 inmates from execution, but seen many of them put to death, including one client he had worked with for the better part of a decade. He also watched his father-in-law fight a losing battle with melanoma and was compelled to have his beloved dog euthanized after a brief illness. In his new book, Dow weaves together parallel narratives of those three kinds of losses and the toll that each of them took on his heart and mind. David Dow is Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and Rorschach Visiting Professor of History at Rice University. His new book is called Things I've Learned from Dying, A Book About Life. He joins us today from the studios of Houston Public Radio. David, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be talking to you again.
So I do want to start with this. The U.S. Supreme Court, of course, refused to stay the execution of Edgar Tamayo. Can you speak just briefly about the arguments used to appeal for his life and how they compare with some of the other arguments that have been used in recent years in defense of death row inmates?
Yes, I think that there were actually several arguments that Mr. Tamayo's lawyers were urging in the last round of litigation, but the principal one and the one that I think received the greatest amount of attention was an argument that Mr. Tamayo had a right when he was originally arrested by the Houston Police Department to be informed that he could contact somebody from the Mexican consulate. That's a right that foreign nationals have as a result of a treaty that the United States is a party to. And law enforcement authorities did not inform Mr. Tamayo of that right, not in my guess because they were acting maliciously, but probably just because they didn't know that he had such a right. But Mr. Tamayo's lawyers were arguing that the violation of that right meant that he should get a new trial, and their basic argument was not simply that the right under the treaty was violated, which it clearly was, but their further argument was that if the right had not been violated, in other words, if the arresting authorities had told Mr. Tamayo that he could contact somebody from the Mexican consulate and he had then done so, the Mexican government would have provided a much more vigorous defense than he received from his court-appointed lawyers who were paid by Harris County taxpayers. The Mexican government would have spent quite a bit more than the county was willing to spend. And their argument was that if the Mexican government had been involved in his trial, he might not have been sentenced to death. He might have been sentenced to life instead. So that was the essential argument that they were making at the end of the litigation.
How did you come to be so deeply committed to death penalty defense?
I came to being a death penalty lawyer, to be perfectly honest, entirely by accident. At the time I began to represent my first client, I wasn't particularly interested in the death penalty as either a legal subject or a moral subject, and I didn't have any expertise whatsoever in representing death row inmates. My life as a practicing lawyer before I joined the University of Houston Law Center had been as a commercial lawyer, not as a criminal lawyer, and definitely not as a death penalty lawyer. But I was teaching a class at the time that had to do with habeas corpus law. Habeas corpus is a legal device that prisoners can use to challenge their convictions or their sentences. And at that time, most of the important habeas corpus cases were death penalty cases. Today, for example, they're not. Today, most of the important habeas corpus decisions grow out of the war on terror and involve people who are being held at Guantanamo Bay. But when I got interested in the work 20 years ago, the important habeas corpus cases were death penalty cases. And so in connection with my love of habeas corpus law, I met one day a number of death row inmates in Texas. And at that time, remarkably, death row inmates in Texas and elsewhere did not have a right to a lawyer during these habeas corpus proceedings. And so one of the guys who I met had an execution date that was just a couple of weeks in the future, and he didn't have a lawyer. And so I agreed to represent him, even though I was not against the death penalty. In fact, if somebody had asked me at the time, I would have said I'm in favor of the death penalty. But I certainly didn't think that the state of Texas should be executing anybody who didn't have a lawyer. And so I agreed to work on that case, even though, as I say, I had no expertise. I figured at least I had access to a law library, and at least I had more than a seventh grade education, which was what this man who was facing execution had on his resume. And so I thought that I would probably be able to do a better job than he would be doing from the confines of death row. And I agreed to work on that case, and I found it challenging and intellectually stimulating. And so I agreed to work on a second, and a second led to a third. And then one day you wake up 20 years later and you've become a death penalty lawyer.
Many of the clients that you have worked with have come from challenging circumstances, but I would say almost universally they have been involved in horrendous crimes. Some of them, I know there have been questions as to whether they were in fact responsible for those crimes, but I wonder how you learn to compartmentalize your feelings about your clients as human beings as opposed to what they were accused and in fact convicted of having done.
That is a truly excellent question, Chris, and I will answer it by telling you that for the first 4, 5, or 6 years that I was a death penalty lawyer, there were two characteristics about myself that I think are relevant to your question. One is that I still wasn't against the death penalty. So I was representing people on death row, and I certainly didn't think that my clients should be executed. But as an abstract matter, I had not even 4, 5, 6 years into my life as a death penalty lawyer developed the view that we should not execute anybody. Mm. And part of the reason for that is that I was not able to compartmentalize in the way that your question has asked. I would frequently think not only about the people who were on death row, but equally and just as much and just as emotionally about the people they had injured, and just as importantly, the people who loved the person they had injured. So while I was defending my clients, I had not by any means developed a view that we shouldn't be executing anybody. The second thing I think that was true about me then, that is not any longer true, but was for a good long while, is that I went out of my way in my early days as a death penalty lawyer not to get to know my clients terribly well at the individual or personal level. I knew that no matter how hard I worked on their behalves, most of them were going to be executed. That's just the nature of being an appellate lawyer who specializes in death penalty work, particularly if you're doing it in Texas. Most of your clients are going to be executed. And so I think in large part as a way of insulating myself against devastation, really, mm-hmm. I went out of my way not to become particularly close to my clients. That changed over time, and it's certainly no longer true now, but it was true for a while, and I think one of the reasons that it was true for a while is precisely because I was never able successfully to focus just on the person in prison to the exclusion of the pain that that person had inflicted on others. And I will tell you that to this day, I think that I'm really quite sensitive to the injury that my clients have caused. I don't want them to be executed, but I'm not a death penalty lawyer who is inattentive to or insensitive to the injury that they've caused, to the hurt that the loved ones of their murder victim continue to feel. And I think that one of the reasons that I've always had a much easier time than many other death penalty lawyers talking to people who support the death penalty is not only because I used to be one of them, but also because I think at a deep emotional and visceral level, I can understand exactly the impulses that they're talking about when they talk about the when they talk about the way in which the criminal justice system very often isn't sufficiently attentive to the needs of family members of murder victims.
You make this clear in the book that by the time their cases are finally are brought to the final appeal, you know more about your clients' lives than almost anyone ever has. And I gather this was the truth even when you were trying to not get to know them on a personal level. You still know every detail, who their teachers were, where they lived when they were certain ages. What kind of information are you gathering in order to try and mount cases in their defense?
This is a very tricky aspect of being a death penalty lawyer, whether you're a death penalty lawyer who does death penalty trials or whether you're an appellate lawyer. And the reason that it's a tricky aspect is because there is a tendency among people to confuse explanation with excuse. Mm-hmm. I, as a death penalty lawyer, am never trying to excuse what my clients have done. What I am trying to do is explain it. And one of the things that death penalty lawyers learn is that there are discoverable explanations. And when you think about it, what we're really trying to determine is how an individual who comes into the world the same way that you and I do, the same way that your listeners do, could turn into somebody who is capable of carrying out an act that we find unimaginable. I cannot even imagine what it would be like to rape and murder a woman, or rape and murder a child, or walk into a convenience store and kill a clerk. I just can't imagine committing those crimes, and I suspect I'm like most people who are law-abiding who can't even imagine committing those crimes. And so what death penalty lawyers try to determine is how their clients, who at some point in their lives probably also couldn't imagine that, came to be people who not only could imagine it, but who actually did it. And we find a number of common occurrences in the backgrounds of 80 or maybe even 85% of the people on death row. I don't even like to say that they grew up in abusive homes, because the word abusive doesn't come remotely close to actually capturing what goes on in the homes of some people on death row. We're talking about parents who punish their children, not just by spanking them on occasion. I was grown up in the era when parents spanked their kids. We're talking about parents who beat their kids literally into unconsciousness, and not just once, and not just twice, but routinely. We're talking about parents who punish their kids by not giving them food or water for days at a time. We're talking about parents who introduce their own children to drugs when the kids are younger than middle school age. We're talking about parents who sexually abuse, physically abuse, psychologically abuse their children in ways that were, and I say this literally, unimaginable to me before I actually began work as a death penalty lawyer and located indisputable evidence of that type of abuse. So what death penalty lawyers are doing when they collect that information is not saying that all of these details are an excuse for murder, because I deeply believe that there aren't any excuses for murder. Mm-hmm. What death penalty lawyers are doing is they are gathering evidence that explains how it is that somebody could come to commit such a crime.
My guest is David R. Dow. He is Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center and Rorschach Visiting Professor of History at Rice University. His new memoir is called Things I've Learned from Dying, a book about life. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You may join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David R. Dow. He is Cullen Professor of at the University of Houston Law Center and Rorschach Visiting Professor of History at Rice University. His new book is called Things I've Learned from Dying, a book about life. If you would like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, David, tell us about the man you refer to here as Eddie Waterman, your client. How did his case come to your attention initially?
I was originally contacted by a judge when his trial began. There are a few judges in Texas who actually begin to think about who they're going to appoint as the appellate lawyers when the trial begin. So even though I didn't yet actually have a client because he might have been acquitted or he might not have been sentenced to death, I was already aware of his case either while the case was in trial or shortly after the trial began, but fairly early on. I didn't actually begin working on the case until later when I was appointed to represent Mr. Waterman. And it was a typical death penalty case in the sense of a case that involved multiple defendants and a victim of a terribly horrible crime and a range of different punishments for the wrongdoers. There were four guys who participated in this murder. Two of them were sentenced to death. Two of them received prison terms. And I was represented to represent Mr. Waterman, who was one of the two who was sentenced to death, and I appointed him throughout his habeas corpus proceedings. It was a somewhat different case from the typical death penalty case, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote about it. What happened in his case was that originally I won, and what it means to win in a case like his is not that he's going to get out of prison, but that his death sentence is going to be transformed into a life sentence. But we ultimately lost that victory on appeal, and so the case essentially started all over again. And so that particular case was, in a lot of ways, two different cases, because everything that typically happens only one time in a death penalty case happened twice in his case. I didn't write about it all happening twice because I didn't want to test the reader's patience. And as you mentioned, I'm also telling two other stories in the book. But my representation of him lasted for so long, in part because his case, for all intents and purposes, was really two different cases.
I was thinking about this reading the book, how strange it must be once someone has been condemned and an execution date is set for you as an attorney, but also as a human being, to see someone sort of healthy and walking around, knowing that they'll be dead within a matter of hours. And then I was contrasting that with the reality that this is exactly the situation that many capital defendants have been in that they took someone who was healthy and all right and took their lives. But can you talk a little bit about that comparison?
Yes. I think if I had to speculate that most people on death row have not thought about precisely that. Mm-hmm. I think that most people on death row have unquestionably reflected on the horrible things that they've done. My experience as a death penalty lawyer is that people on death row become remorseful, not because they're scared of being executed. In fact, for many of them, they would actually prefer to be executed. They become remorseful because they actually focus on the terrible things that they've done, and that causes them to feel remorse. But I don't think that they ever analogize their own situation to the situation of their victims. I think that there are some death penalty opponents who tend to do that, and it makes my skin crawl when they do that because it tends to suggest a moral equivalence between the person who's being executed and the homicide victim.
Right.
And I don't think there's moral equivalence. I'm against the death penalty. I don't think the state ought to be executing anybody. But I also think that somebody who kills an innocent person is doing something that is bad. and that therefore that person has done something bad in a way that somebody who has not killed somebody else has not. And I don't think that there is moral equivalence between those two positions. But more important than what I think is that I don't think my clients think that. My clients don't think that there is moral equivalence between themselves and their victims. So I don't think that they think of themselves as like their victims. I think that they think of themselves as people who unjustifiably took a human life. That doesn't mean that they think that the state ought to execute them. I'm not saying that. But I also don't think that they view themselves as equivalent to their victims. And so therefore, I must say that I don't really either. And one of the things that I try to do in the book is to sketch out the difference between a sudden death, a death that results from an impulsive act, an unplanned act, a criminal act, on the one hand, versus, on the other hand, a death that is calculated and deliberated and planned over days, weeks, months, which is what executions are. Execution dates are set at least a month in advance, more commonly 3 months in advance, and sometimes 5, 6, 7 months in advance. And so there is a long time that everybody has to get ready for it. And by everybody, I mean the prosecutors, the defense lawyers, I mean the prison officials, and of course, I also mean the inmate and the people who love the inmate. It might be moms and dads. It might be spouses or partners. It might be brothers or sisters. In many cases, it's sons and daughters. And so there are a whole lot of people who are marking off days on the calendar with a big red X when there's an execution date set. And that creates a very different dynamic, I think, than was the dynamic that was present in the original homicide that caused the person to find himself on death row in the first place.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Mark in Dallas on the phone. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi. Glad to hear. I have a fellow abolitionist. I used to be in favor of the death penalty, but I grew to understand that his implications and how kind of morally wrong it was. My question is it recently? This is kind of a it's very relatable, but it's becoming more accepting of hemp, cannabis, of course, like Colorado. More people are, you know, they've changed the laws where they legalized marijuana use, and also gay marriage has been more accepted. Do you think the death penalty will kind of be like that, where we will become more of an abolitionist country, or do you think we'll ever grow to that extent, and specifically Texas, because they're, you know, much different from the rest of the country, statistically speaking?
Thanks for your call, Mark. What do you think, David?
I should preface my answer by saying, and my wife will attest to this, that my predictions are always wrong. So if there's money to be made, then what you really want to do is bet on exactly the opposite of what I say. But that said, if I had to guess, I would guess that we are not going to become an abolitionist country or an abolitionist state during my lifetime or the lifetime of my son or the lifetime of his children, if he has children. He's only 13 right now. I think we're going to get rid of the death penalty, but it won't be because we've become an abolitionist state. And here's what I think is the difference between the marijuana example and the same-sex marriage example and the death penalty example. I think the difference has a whole lot to do with empathy. Even if you yourself have not smoked marijuana either ever or anytime recently, you almost certainly know people who have. Even if you yourself are in a heterosexual relationship rather than a homosexual relationship, you almost certainly know people who are different, who are in a homosexual relationship rather than a heterosexual relationship. And I think that our knowledge of others, when it comes to marijuana usage, when it comes to issues of gay rights, equality, and same-sex marriage, is more capable of being informed by empathy, because we know people, even if it's not ourselves, who have those characteristics. I think when it comes to the death penalty, that's not really so true. There aren't a whole lot of people who know somebody who's committed murder. And I think that that creates a real inability to empathize. It's exactly the reason why death penalty lawyers have such a difficult time trying to maintain the distinction between explanation and excuse. When I start talking about reasons that explain why one of my clients did what he did, people say, you're trying to excuse that. And I have to say, no, I'm not. I'm trying to explain to you how somebody got into this position. But because the people who I'm trying to explain it to are so far removed from the circumstances that I'm trying to describe, they not only don't know anybody who grew up in those circumstances, but they therefore don't even know what it means to have grown up in those circumstances. And so for those reasons, I think that the dynamic in the death penalty debate is really very different from the dynamic in other sorts of political debates, including same-sex marriage and marijuana. Now, that's not to say I don't think we're going to get rid of the death penalty. I think we will get rid of the death penalty, but I think that it's going to be for economic reasons rather than moral reasons. The death penalty is such a profligate waste of social resources that we're going to stop doing it just because it's better to fix the streets and fix the schools and make sure that people have health insurance. And you can pay for a whole lot of those things if you do away with the death penalty.
So the other human death that you explore here is one that is probably more relatable to many people who are listening. It was a family member, your father-in-law. He was diagnosed with melanoma. Sounds like really, first of all, an amazing guy. Can you just tell us a little bit about his life before we talk about how his life ended?
Yes, and Chris, thank you for letting me. He was an amazing guy. His name was Peter. He was my father-in-law, but he was also a dear friend of mine. He taught me how to windsurf. We used to go kayaking together. He was an avid outdoorsman. He's one of these guys who was hiking across Nepal and Bhutan 35, 40 years ago before it was the rage to do it. He was one of these guys who was doing it when there wasn't a satellite beacon that would help a helicopter locate you and rescue you if you got into trouble. You had to know what you were doing. In addition to being a very accomplished outdoorsman, he was also a real intellectual. He was a PhD in chemistry. He spent most of his professional life as a laboratory chemist and then the rest of his professional life managing and supervising other laboratory chemists. But his interests were diverse. He was interested in history and in architecture and in physics and particularly in music. We talked a lot about music. And he was simply a dear, dear friend of mine who also happened to be my father-in-law. And when he was 58 years old, a relatively young man, he was diagnosed with melanoma. The melanoma ultimately killed him in less than 2 years. He died when he was barely 60. And I wanted to write about it, not only because I loved him and not only because I thought he was a really great and, more importantly, good human being, but also because his struggle with melanoma revealed something to me that I had never paid any attention to before. Maybe I hadn't even ever seen it before, although I suspect that some of your listeners might have. And what I'm talking about in particular had to do with the conflict between what he wanted to do with the rest of his life and what the people who loved him most, his wife and his son and his daughter, who's my wife, wanted him to do. And those two strategies didn't point in the same direction. He, I think, was of the view that he would be better off by not pursuing any therapies. He thought that he was going to lose his ability to do things outdoors. He thought that he was going to lose his ability to think and to read. And in view of that, he I think, thought that a swift death would be better than a prolonged one. His family, on the other hand, his wife and his son and his daughter and me, for that matter, wanted him to be around for however long we could have him, even if he wasn't able to do other things, even if he wasn't able to go mountain climbing, he would still be able to have Thanksgiving dinner with us. And so you had these two groups of people. You had the person who was facing death, but then you had the person or the people who loved the person facing death. And what was best for one was not necessarily what was best for all of the others. And that's one of the dynamics that I try to explore with that line of the narrative in the book.
Yeah, of course, in theory, I think all of us agree that we want to honor the wishes of the dying. But in so many ways, that really only works in the abstract for a lot of families.
I think that in most ways, it works only in the abstract. In fact, I asked a question at the beginning of the book. At the very beginning of the book, I ask a question. I say, how would you rather die? Would you rather be able to circle a date on a calendar 6 months from today and know that on that day your life was going to end? Or would you rather just get hit by a truck crossing the street and never see it coming? And by the middle of the book, I've shifted the focus a bit, and I'm not asking exactly how you would want to die if you got to choose. I'm asking how you would want your loved ones to die if you got to choose how they were going to die. And what's the reason that I do that is because I don't believe that many people's answers would be the same. I think for a lot of people, when they're thinking about their own deaths, they would rather go to sleep one night and have a heart attack and not wake up. But that's not how they want their loved ones to die, because then they won't get to say goodbye.
My guest is David R. Dow. He is Cullen Professor at the University of Houston Law Center, Rorschach Visiting Professor of History at Rice University. His new book is called Things I've Learned from Dying, A Book About Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to financial planning. Spring registration is open now. You can learn more and register online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with David R. Dow, who is founder of the Texas Innocence Network and author of the new book, Things I've Learned from Dying, A Book About Life. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, David, what did it feel like when your father-in-law asked you for help in helping your wife in particular sort of let go and allow him to leave this earth with as much control as possible?
I don't mean to be flip about it, because it was obviously a sad and tragic time in my life, in his life, in my wife's life. But that is the definition of between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah.
He wanted to do one thing, and my wife wanted him to do the opposite. And from my perspective, both of their desires made sense from their own individual perspectives. I thought to myself that if I were in my father-in-law's position, I would want to do exactly what he wanted to do, which was to drive out west and climb mountains until one day he just died on top of a mountain.
And in fact, excuse me for interrupting, that's what he told you. He said, I could die on a mountain or I could die, you know, chained to a hospital bed.
That's what he said. He said, mm-hmm. He said that if he drove out west, he would die on a mountaintop. And if he didn't, he would die in diapers in an air-conditioned room. Hmm. And one of them was attractive to him, obviously, and one of them wasn't. And I felt when I was talking to him that if I had been in his position, I would have had exactly the same viewpoint and desire. And on the other hand, my wife was close to her father from the day she was born. They just had a truly wonderful father-daughter relationship, and she learned a lot from him, and she loved to talk to him, and she enjoyed benefiting from his experience and his wisdom. And so she wanted him to be around. And from my point of view, her view also made perfect sense. Hmm. And if I'd been in her position, I would have wanted exactly what she wanted. And so I was in a position of thinking that both of them were right in terms of what made sense for them. And the problem, of course, is that there isn't a compromise to that conflict. Some conflicts do, in fact, have compromises. Some people don't want to raise taxes. Some people want to raise them a lot. You compromise by staking out some middle ground. There wasn't a middle ground between what my father-in-law wanted and what his daughter wanted. And so I felt like no matter what view I expressed, I would be being unfaithful to one of these two people who I loved and cared about very much. I will say that ultimately, I think my father-in-law didn't do everything in the way of pursuing therapy, but he did a whole lot more than he would have done if he hadn't been trying to honor the desires of my wife and his wife and his son, who wanted him to stick around for as long as he could.
So the final death that you explore here is that of your dog, Winona. And I think, you know, people might hear that and think, how can you possibly compare this, unless they've had, a dear pet? And been responsible, ultimately 100% responsible for making those end-of-life decisions.
Yes. I, Chris, you might be right, but what I think is that anybody who has had a pet will not have that question, mm-hmm. and they will understand why, in several respects, that was actually the hardest of the three stories for me to live through, and also the hardest to write. A couple of reasons I think explain why that's true. One is that in the case of my client, I was doing everything I could to keep him alive. In the case of my father-in-law, I was offering my advice, I was answering questions, I was giving my opinion, but I really had nothing to do with the decision. In the case of our dog, the dog's name was Winona. She was a female Doberman. My wife and I got her before we were married, actually. I say she died from acute liver failure. She went from being perfectly healthy one day to being literally at death's door the next day. It was not a gradual decline. And although I say she died from acute liver failure, which is what the death certificate would say if they had death certificates for dogs, the truth is that she died because my wife and I made the decision to have her euthanized at the time we made that decision. And so there is an act of human intervention. There was an act of mine in that case that caused the death in a way that was not true in the other two cases. And I think that that partly explains why, in many ways, that episode was harder for me to write about and, truthfully, in many ways, harder to live through. But there's another factor, too. And the other factor is that our son is now 13 years old, but when he was born, the dog who I write about in the book was 5. So from the day we brought our son home from the hospital, the dog, Winona, was in his life for every single day of his life. And Winona ultimately died when our son was 8. And I did not anticipate how devastated he was going to be when Winona died. And I therefore made some decisions, and I think I made the decisions. I would like to be able to attribute them to both my wife and me, except that she was actually resisting them. I think I made some decisions that had some painful, some deeply painful consequences that I simply didn't expect or anticipate in any way. And so I therefore have regret that is associated with the Winona narrative in the book that I don't have with either of the other two narratives. Obviously, I would like for all three of the cases to have come out differently, but there's only one of the storylines that caused me then deep regret and that makes me remember and feel anew the same regret every time I think about those days and weeks and months.
I think what you're referring to here is that your son, when he found out that the dog was sick, had, in the way that little kids will do, had made her like a get well card and said, "Can I bring this to her tomorrow at the animal hospital?" And you said, "Absolutely."
I had promised him that we would go see her again. Mm-hmm. We had been visiting her at the emergency clinic. She got very suddenly ill. She went to the emergency clinic. She ultimately never came home from the emergency clinic. And of course, one of the regrets that I talk about in the book that I also feel is that I wish we had brought her home and let her die at home. I think she wanted to do that. But I had promised our son on a Tuesday morning that when he got home from school, we would go visit her again. We'd been visiting her every day. And he said good, because he was going to make a card for her. And shortly after he left for school, the doctor who had been attending to her called to report that Winona had gotten seriously worse over the course of the night, which was hard for me to imagine because I didn't see how she could even get that much worse. She was essentially comatose already. But we went to see her, and she was indeed worse, and made the decision upon seeing her to have her euthanized. And our son walked in the door, and we told him immediately. We met him at the door, and he was devastated. I to this day, it's been more than, well, it's been right around 5 years, as a matter of fact. And to this day, I can still hear the wailing sounds that he made. And our son at the time, he was 8 years old, and I think maybe a lot of parents of young kids wonder at times about what their own children's familiarity with the concept of death is and how they would respond to deaths. Our son, I thought, was a pretty sophisticated 8 year old, because he had known from the days that he could first use human language to communicate what I do for a living. Neither my wife nor I had ever hid that from him. So he had heard a whole lot about people dying. And I feel like he was way more sophisticated about death than most 8 year olds were. And yet, even so, I was not prepared for how destroyed he was going to be by the death of the dog, and in particular, by his not getting to say goodbye to the dog. One of the reasons, of course, that the story of Winona is parallel to the stories of Peter and my client is that a lot of what those stories have to do with is the opportunity to say goodbye. And Peter's family got to say goodbye to him. One of the issues for my client was that he desperately wanted to reconnect with his daughter, from whom he had been estranged for many years, so that he could say goodbye to her and apologize to her. And he didn't get that opportunity, but Peter's family did get the opportunity. And I feel regret that my son didn't get the opportunity to say goodbye to a pet that he deeply wanted the opportunity to say goodbye to.
I mean, David, obviously you don't have the power to prevent death, as no one does, but it does seem as parents, right, it's not simply that we I mean, we can talk to our kids about these things, but did it feel like your first failure as a parent to not have handled this in a way that turned out to feel like the right way?
It felt like my biggest. It certainly wasn't my first. I in fact, tell the story in the book about some other failures that had to do with bringing bad days home from the office with me. If you're a death penalty lawyer in Texas, you have a whole lot of bad days at the office. And it took me a very long time to get reasonably competent. I'm still not perfectly competent, but to get reasonably competent at leaving the bad day at the office so that I didn't bring it home and have it interfere with my relationship with my wife or my relationship with my son. So it was certainly not my first failure, but I think that it was unquestionably, up until that point in his life at any rate, my biggest and most consequential failure. He didn't, our son didn't react to any of my other failures in the way that he reacted to that one. In fact, he's a very forgiving kid. And I wrote an earlier book, my last book, that I also talked to you about, was a book called The Autobiography of an Execution. Mm-hmm. And in that book, I tell some of the stories about not being a good dad. He went on to either Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, I can't remember, and he wrote a review and he said, "I'm the Lincoln who's in the book." His son is Lincoln. And he said, "I just want to say that all the places my dad says that he was a bad dad, it's not true. He's a great dad." And he's always been a very forgiving kid in that way. But with the Winona episode, I think that he's probably forgiven me by now. I haven't asked him about it. But it was not by any means immediate. It was an injury that he felt for a good long while.
Have you not asked him because you don't want to know the answer?
I haven't asked him because he would say that he has forgiven me even if it isn't true. But because he's also a very sensitive kid besides being forgiven. But I think that he's forgiven me by now. We left town shortly after Winona died because we just really needed to be away. And we were gone for a while. I came back sooner than my wife and son did because I had to go back to work. And when I came back, I went to the dog rescue sites to do all the paperwork so that if he ever wanted to get another dog, we'd be in a position to. And we ultimately did get another dog. And I think getting the other dog helped him forgive me, in part because we got another dog on the condition that he agreed to be responsible for him with me. This dog is a male. And so he's now had a taste of the responsibility that he hadn't had before. And he realizes that the only way you can make mistakes is when you have responsibility, because if you don't, then there's not anything that you can ever do that's wrong.
The new book by David R. Dow is called Things I've Learned from Dying, A Book About Life. He joined us today from the studios of Houston Public Radio. David, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. It's always a pleasure for me too, Chris. I hope we get to talk again one day soon.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.